Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
Welcome to our program today. I'm Tricia House, and I'm here to welcome John Smith, a friend of mine, a fine amateur, and well-rounded musician and fellow churchman. Hello, John.
Hello, Trish.
Are you involved in concerts at the moment?
Well, not personally, but we do have a concert coming up at St. Mary's on Sunday, which is the Soundings Choir run by Dennis Donnelly, well known to the conservatory here. And my wife Sue and I are singing in the Bach B minor Mass, which is going to be at Christ Church Cathedral next Saturday, May the 31st. One of the world's great pieces of music.
That is definitely an enthusiastic amateur. This wonderful interest in music started in another country. Can you tell us a little bit about this other country's background?
I was born in England, and I went to school in England, where I was privileged, I guess, to have a wonderful director of music who introduced me to the wonders of English church music. But also, because I was playing the violin quite a lot at that time, I became very interested in orchestral music. I used to attend the promenade concerts at the Albert Hall in London on a very regular basis, sometimes three times a week. This is probably one of the world's great orchestral festivals, which has been going for a very, very long time. And you don't just get the standard repertoire, but you also get a lot of new and challenging music. And I learned a lot of my orchestral music by attending those concerts.
At this school, sometimes you'd be called sissy to be in a choir. Would you agree with that?
Well, there were some people who didn't think that it was the right thing to do to join the school choir or the school chapel choir, but I did. I was impatient with people who pretended not to be able to sing, and I could sing. I had a reasonably strong treble voice, and after my voice broke and after a year of struggling to find out whether I was a tenor or a bass, I have basically sung baritone all my life.
I come from Australia, which you can definitely hear. And it was my mother who was instrumental in getting me piano lessons, singing lessons, into theatre performances. Was there anybody in your family who'd really had that background that would give you some leading?
Well, my father was tone deaf. He used to say that he couldn't tell Pop Goes the King from Pop Goes the Weasel, or some strange phrase like that. So he had no interest, and I think was probably impatient with my interest in music. My mother was very supportive, and she was a piano. She could play the piano, and so there was some support from my mother. And her father had been an organist and violin player, so she was delighted that I was playing the violin.
I had a wonderful opportunity of visiting Cambridge, and you are very privileged to have been there as a student. So would you tell us a little bit about that background?
Yes, I went to Cambridge on a history scholarship, but immediately started studying law because my father said that with history, all you get to do is be a teacher, and you don't get much money being a teacher. That was his view. So I studied law at Cambridge, and I also and got my law degree at Cambridge, and then subsequently was actually called to the bar in England at one of the temples called the Middle Temple, and then left almost immediately for Canada. But while I was at Cambridge, I certainly was involved with a lot of music. I sang with a madrigal group, I sang in a chapel choir, and the Cambridge University Music Society had an orchestra and a chorus, and sometimes it was a bit of a struggle to decide whether I was going to play the violin, the viola, or sing.
Was there any particular performance there that you became involved in?
Well, I did play an important part in putting on a performance of The Messiah, which was entirely run by the students, which was interesting. And also there was an occasion when I was in the Comes Orchestra. We were doing a very little-known opera called Joan of Arc at the Stake, Jean d'Arc au Blücher, by Hindemith, and it was a shock to us when we suddenly realized that Vaughan Williams was in the audience, because he had never heard the work, and so he came all the way to Cambridge to hear it. He died about a year later.
So you came to Toronto. How did you end up in Vancouver?
Well, I was only in Toronto while a student. I was in Toronto in 1958 as a summer student with a law firm. But I was given letters of introduction, and I came on the train to Vancouver in, I guess it was, the train was, I guess it's basically the same train trip today as it was then. I was in Vancouver in, I think it was September 1958, and I went to several different law firms and arranged with one of them to take me on as an articling student after I had returned to England, completed my legal studies, which involved getting called to the bar, along the way got married, and then left for Canada at the very end of 1959, and I started articling with a major law firm at the beginning of 1960.
That led you into interesting work in cancer, well before we had a BC Cancer Agency.
Well, that's a long time later. We've just jumped 30 something years.
My
work at the law firm was largely, well, it was to do with estate planning and estate taxes. I was actually on the Carter Royal Commission, or I was on the staff of the Carter Royal Commission on taxation that basically introduced capital gains taxation into Canada in the late 60s. But I was I was in Ottawa for a year and a half on that Royal Commission, and then did a lot of work doing planning for startup companies and societies. Then later on became very much involved in entertainment law, which was quite a new venture back in those days. But I did some work for motion picture companies, and particularly on the financing side, which led me to ultimately leave this very large law firm after some 30-something years.
Successfully moved, didn't we?
Yeah. And I became in-house counsel for a group that raised money for doing film financing for film productions and television series productions mostly in Vancouver, but some in Toronto. And then after that, because the tax laws changed so that it was no longer possible to continue the raising of money for investment in television and motion picture production with a tax benefit, I became involved with the first company in Canada to have privately a PET scanner, a positron emission tomography scanner, which is the most effective method of determining the presence of cancer and determining the level of that cancer. And PET scanning is still today probably the most important method of determining whether there is cancer and analyzing the level of that cancer. And it was an exciting time because we had the first PET scanner in British Columbia, the first private PET scanner in the whole of Canada, and that company still exists today. It's always been a struggle because it was not part of the public health healthcare system and was not part of the BC Cancer Agency, but the company has done hundreds, probably thousands of PET scans, and each time it's a benefit to the patient.
So how did the BC Cancer Agency get into that?
Well, the BC Cancer Agency regards PET scanning as part of their mandate, and so it is. So it was never easy to marry the bureaucracy's view of who should be doing cancer and who should be looking after cancer patients with the need for PET scanning in the private sector. At certain points, BC Cancer Agency was unable to keep up with the demand. It always was a challenge because having a PET scan is an expensive procedure. We had to charge in the region of $2,500 for a PET scan. But if you only have one PET scan in your lifetime, that's not a price which is beyond most people's ability to pay, and it produces results.
You've used music, or music has been there all your life in a variety of forms. A lot of people just do singing or performing, or, you know, just keep themselves into one or two areas. But you have performed, and then you've done some great help to various organizations. Can you tell us a little about your life from that point of view?
I have always been interested in singing, and I've always sung in. I've sung in a number of different choirs in Vancouver and in Ottawa and in Victoria, and I'm singing in choirs in Victoria now. Well, right now I sing in the St. Christopher Singers, which does evensong at the cathedral on Sunday evenings, and I'm singing in with Capriccio, which is putting on the performance of the Bach B minor Mass on May the 31st, and I'm not a permanent member of Capriccio, but I couldn't pass up on the opportunity to sing in once more one of the world's greatest pieces of music, and probably one of the world's greatest pieces of art that exists. It's very challenging for I'm now 78 years old, and so some of the runs in the back are a little beyond me, but I'm hanging in there. But in addition to doing that singing, I have also been involved quite a lot during my life in basically administration, if you like, of organizations. I was at one point the president of the Vancouver Bach Choir, and I sang with the Vancouver Cantata Singers, and have sung with some other choirs. But also I was one of the founding members of the BC Choral Federation, which is an umbrella organization which looks after choirs across British Columbia. And it's really an incredibly successful organization. I assisted in forming it, and I was, in fact, the first president. It does fabulous work. The people who run it now are just absolutely wonderful people, and I'm very privileged to still have some involvement with the BC Choral Federation. I've also helped to incorporate other choral groups, other chamber music groups, so I used my legal expertise to assist with that. The other very big part of my life for some 15 years was the Vancouver Symphony. I started being the secretary on the board. I became a director of the society. I then became vice president, involved with some music planning, and then ultimately became the president of the Vancouver Symphony, and had it was a very challenging and very exciting time. The symphony was in major financial difficulties, and ultimately a few years after I left, it actually did go technically bankrupt, though it got sort of bailed out of that. But one of my exciting times with the Vancouver Symphony was a trip to Japan when Akiyama was the music director. We did the symphony did a tour of Japan, which was something like about 8 or 10 concerts. And I, as the president, got to go, which was very exciting for me.
Two things, John. I know you're retired now, but you've still got your finger in the pie of helping one legal person by consulting. Can you tell us about that one?
Yes, I had some difficulty finding out how to spell the word retired, and sometimes it surprises me that I'm still doing things, but I do some work for a motion picture production and distribution company, actually stationed now, or headed up anyway, in Las Vegas, but I do some consulting work for them. And I'm doing other sort of some consulting work for people who want to deal with the development of a society which needs to have charitable registration. And I because I've done that sort of thing, I'm still doing some of those types of things.
Like you, I'm retired. I'm not a singer, or I used to be, but I'm not anymore. And I struggle with keeping my hands organized to play at the level that I really can play at. How did you keep your voice all these years?
Well, I thought I'd lost it because at one point I took another stab at trying to help the PET scanning company, and I was living in Victoria, but I was spending 3 days a week in Vancouver at a company office, and so I basically cancelled all my other obligations because I couldn't fit them all in, and so for about a couple of years, I guess, I didn't sing, and then I was at that time singing, I had been singing with the Linden Singers, and Gary Fraze at that time was the music director, was the conductor and music director of Linden Singers. And when I finally extricated myself from traveling to Vancouver every week early on a Monday morning and coming back late on a Wednesday or Thursday, I went to Gary and said, can I please audition? And he said, oh, you don't need to audition. I said, yes, I think I do. And so I sang for him, and he said, oh, you're fine. You can still sing, so come back and join us. And I had a very pleasant time singing with the Linden Singers for a short time after that.
Amongst all the directors, music directors that you have worked with over the years, are there any particular person, one of them, or two of them that you would like to share with what you learned from them?
Well, when I, in the very early days of the Vancouver Symphony, I was also singing in the Bach Choir as well as being on the board of the symphony. And Meredith Davies was the conductor and music director of the Vancouver Symphony. And we did the first, and I don't know if it's been done since in Vancouver, but we did the first performance in Vancouver of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. And Meredith Davies was the conductor. And he was a very difficult man to please. Very difficult to please indeed. I mean, he was a superb musician. But it was sometimes pretty tough, and there was an assistant conductor who got us ready for it before Meredith Davies came to the later rehearsals, and his name was Bev Fife, and he was a sweet man, but he was absolutely terrified of Meredith Davies. So that was interesting. There've been some other wonderful people that I've sung under. Bruce Pullen is an absolutely superb musician that I've had the pleasure of singing under, because the BC Choral Federation has an annual event where there's massed choirs, and Bruce was conducting on one occasion, two occasions that I can remember, and that was lots of fun also.
Here's a name you have worked with, Michael Gormley.
Oh. Well, Michael has been the director of music at Christchurch Cathedral, that's the Anglican Cathedral, since 1984. So that's a long time, and he is a wonderful musician. He was involved with the Vienna Boys Choir before that. He trained in Vienna. He's dearly loved by all of us who have sung under him or with him over the years. He's demanding, but he probably knows more about Bach than any of us ever will learn about.
Near the beginning of this interview, we talked about the violin and the viola. Somehow it got sort of not talked about on the way, so let's just look back at those two instruments.
Well, when I was a teenager, I was playing the violin and the viola a lot at school. Sorry, the violin. And then I realized that if I wanted to play in quartets at college, it was better to play the viola because there was a demand. There were lots of violinists, but not very many viola players. So I struggled with the viola clef, which is awkward, and did learn to play the viola. So at one point I had two violins and a viola, and I enjoyed playing them. I then got so busy as a lawyer that you just can't play the violin unless you practice very regularly. I think it was Zighetti, or no, maybe it was, I can't remember which great violinist it was, who said, if I don't practice for 2 days in a row, my audience knows, and if I don't practice for 1 day, I know. And that, I think that's true. If you don't keep practicing, you lose it. And so at one point, I actually sold both of my violins and viola. But I was delighted when my family, I think I was, it was either my 60th birthday or my 65th, they bought me a violin, which was very nice.
Your present wife, Sue, and yourself do something very, very interesting for the music on the peninsula, something quite unique, and it's growing. I believe it's in its eighth season.
Yes, we started Sunday Serenade, which are concerts given on Sunday afternoons at St. Mary's Church in Sanishton. I think we saw around about 9 or 10 years ago that there was a real need for music that was approachable, pleasant, not too highbrow, that would be available at a reasonable price for people living on the peninsula. And so we do, Sunday Serenade does four concerts each year, usually one in October, one in November, December, one in January, February, and one in March, April. And so we have choirs, we have music chamber groups, we have soloists, and it's always it seems to have caught on, because as you say, Trish, it's now the eighth season, and we have we've got a good following that stays with us. The audience is, we always hope we're going to get 100. We never quite get 100. Well, we do sometimes if we have the if we have the Greater Victoria Police Chorus, people turn up in excess of 100, because they're a wonderful group. They give pleasure to a lot of people.
I believe also in your spare time you have been a writer of short stories and poetry, and I would like you to read one of your poems. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, well, a long time ago I started going to writing courses, and I was encouraged to write short stories and also some poetry. And so I've been doing that. I've probably written something like 100 short stories and a whole scad of poetry, some to woo my wife. I still do write some poetry and short stories. I've sent some in competitions. I very, very seldom win anything, but there we are. It's a pleasure for me. Recently, I wrote three poems, which are all about beaches. That's not beech trees, but beaches where there's sand. And so I called it Three Beach Stories, and I'll just read the first one, which is called Secret. embedded deep in sifted sand, now beyond the pull of any ebbing tide, lies a dinosaur, or what is left of its primordial hulk, 50 feet of apportioned bone in symmetry, undisturbed by passing millennia. No one knows about it, but the eagles, keepers of mysteries, and those who wonder why, in the fullness of a solstice tide, the sea out there brims with purple, the blood of gods, welled up from far below and washed away by morning's ebb to leave no trace for disturbance. But still it's there. That's the matter. Things may fester, fall apart, but still it's there.
To close our program, we always have our interviewees choose a piece of music, and you've chosen something from Benjamin Britten. Would you introduce it, please?
Yes, I think Benjamin Britten is very important to me and very important to English music. When Benjamin Britten started to make his presence felt in the 1950s in England, I think it was recognized that here was a star, a man who moved away from being sort of a slave to the traditions of English music and English nationalism and English folk music, and he established a voice all his own. And, of course, he was also an amazing man. He went against the tide. He was a pacifist, which was very unpopular during the Second World War. He was a homosexual. Peter Pierce was his companion for decades. And I've always felt that the music reflects that very singularity that he has. He wrote an opera called Peter Grimes, which was first performed in 1945, and it was the beginning, I think, of the resurgence of the greatness of British opera. From that has been developed an orchestral suite called 4C Interludes, and the first of those 4C Interludes is called Dawn. That is the piece that I've always loved. It, I think it depicts dawn beautifully. In fact, sometimes I think it also depicts a glimpse of heaven.
Thanks, John, and we really appreciate you spending time with us today.
So I'm here in the studio with Professor Jeremy Weber, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Law here at the University of Victoria. We are going to be discussing the Law Society of BC's general membership vote to deny the accreditation of Trinity Western's proposed law school because of its anti-gay message. Just to set this up, the Federation of Law Societies of Canada and the Law Society of BC's benchers had already voted to accept Trinity Western's graduates, at which point the BC lawyers signed a petition to put the vote to the society's general membership, which resulted in a favorable vote for a motion asking that the benchers reject the school. This is because all students attending the school have to sign a covenant rejecting sex before marriage, where sex is defined as being between a man and a woman, thus condemning homosexual sex. So with this in mind, can you further, or well, I'll just say hello, how are you doing?
Really well. How about yourself?
Great. So with all of this in mind, can you further explain why Trinity Western creating a law school is particularly troublesome to BC lawyers and the law?
It's a little bit difficult to say precisely why people have made the decision that they have, because the debate is quite decentralized. Before the benchers themselves, the benchers tends to be the ordinary decision-making structure for the lawyers in BC. Before them, before the benchers, there in fact were no no reasons given for the benchers as a corporate body. It was just the reasons given by the individual members of that body in the course of making their decision. And then, of course, when it went to the membership, although there were speeches made, then, of course, one has a vote, and it's a little bit difficult to sift out exactly why people voted which way. You know, I think there's really kind of two issues that have been discussed in this debate. Mm-hmm. One is whether it's acceptable to have a law school that teaches from this perspective, that teaches from an evangelical Christian perspective that, at least in this instance, takes the position that marriage can only be between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. So there are some people who object to the very fact that a law school takes that position, or that people at a law school take that position. Mm-hmm. To tell you the truth, I actually don't think, though, that's a majority position within the law society. I've been listening carefully to the debate. We've actually had a comparable debate occur within the faculty as well. Mm-hmm. And the impression I get is that most people take the position that even though they may not, many people don't agree with that view of marriage, mm-hmm. they take the position that any law school has to teach, take a critical approach to law, has to evaluate whether the law is good as it is or how it should be moving, and that it's got to be possible to take that a position that's grounded in religious belief. That I think has, over the course of time, tended to be accepted by at least a very substantial number mm-hmm. of people in the profession. Mm-hmm. And the issue has tended to come to focus on the aspect that every student is forced to sign a covenant mm-hmm. that says that they won't engage in sexual intimacy on a same-sex basis, that defines marriage as being only between a man and a woman, mm-hmm. And that that covenant really then ends up meaning that it's certainly impossible for a practicing same-sex couple to be admitted in conscience to the law school. They can't enter into that covenant, and mm-hmm. it's that discrimination at the basis of admission. Mm-hmm. The question of whether it's appropriate for the law society to put its stamp of approval mm-hmm. on a program that really discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation in its admissions, mm-hmm. whether that's the problem. And so, kind of two issues: the general issue about whether marriage has to be heterosexual. People have tended to come to the position that it's got to be possible for a law school to teach from that perspective, even though they don't agree with it. But the second issue, the harder issue, is it really permissible then to kind of discriminate at the point of admissions? Mm-hmm.
But I think an important distinction to make is that individuals can be both lawyers and Christian, or any religion that they believe in, but it is problematic when that Christian doctrine is embedded into a student learning and interpretation of the law. Can you kind of expand on this? Like, when you learn under a Christian idea, that's how you're going to interpret the law and argue the law within Canada. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people have really come to the position that, listen, we all bring stuff to the law, mm-hmm. right? You can't teach the law without having some substantive commitments and having those commitments shape the way you teach it. Because you're always teaching the law critically, right? In law schools, we're not just telling people what the rules are. Mm-hmm. We're also talking about how those rules should be interpreted, how they should be evolve with time, whether they're appropriate, whether they're consistent with the Charter of Rights. Mm-hmm. So you're always engaging with the law critically. So that means you never take the law just simply as it is. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think there's a really good argument that you can't even understand what the law is mm-hmm. if you don't engage with it critically, right? You kind of have to ask, wow, is this consistent with the Charter of Rights? Mm-hmm. Do I have to rethink this? Could this be successfully challenged? You have to kind of engage with it critically. Mm-hmm. And I think most people would say that also has to be true from the perspective of conscientious religious believers. Mm-hmm. They have to be able to say, listen, we actually don't think that this gives sufficient allowance for religious differentiation. We actually think that properly understood, marriage has this character. That has to be possible. And of course, when those people go out into the community, there is an expectation that they will behave professionally, that they won't pretend that something is the law when in fact the courts have decided something opposite. And I think now most people accept that that's true, that the problem is not that we're going to have a bunch of biased lawyers coming out of the institution. The problem is really whether there's an issue about putting one stamp of approval on a program where people are screened out mm-hmm. on a basis that really looks like it's discrimination on a prohibited ground.
Right. So can you explain why this would be important, that distinction of it being discriminatory from the beginning is important within the law?
Yeah, no, that's really good. The reason why this distinction is important in this is that it almost certainly would be okay. TWU's program would almost certainly be accredited with the support of the majority of the members of the Law Society if the covenant were either changed so that it no longer discriminated on the basis of sexual orientation, or if they made the covenant optional. Mm-hmm. It's only a surmise, but my reading of the profession is that there would not be an objection to having a law school that took the position that we're teaching the law with a distinctive attention to, distinctive regard for, evangelical Christian principles. Mm. That would not be objectionable. That's no more objectionable than having a law prof who draws upon another set of philosophical principles in their teaching, or another set of political commitments that it shape, for example, a very strong commitment to equality. Mm. Those kinds of commitments have to be part of law school, and that goes for religiously based commitments as well. Mm. So that's not the problem. The problem really is the effect of the covenant at the level of admissions, and whether that can be seen as being an acceptable framework in which to satisfy the academic requirements for admission to the legal profession.
Mm. I think, disagree a little bit. I think given the historical context of the Canadian state and our government, we have certain leanings towards acceptance of Christian doctrine within our general society. Do you think that the Bar Association and or other associations would have an issue if this same faculty was put forward by another religion? If, for instance, given anti-Muslim sentiment in North America, if a law school wanted to have a law school that promoted Sharia law as their teaching, would that be the same problems? It sounds to me like you're saying that their Christian doctrine is not a problem. And I think that it's hard to equate Christian doctrine with political belief in equality.
Right. It's a good question. That there's no doubt that if you look at society as a whole, that Christian doctrines are generally seen to be more acceptable mm-hmm. than at least some doctrines that are associated with Islam or mm-hmm. or with other minority religions. I think, you know, it's true that's true. It's not as though all religious beliefs are treated as equivalently in social interaction mm-hmm. in Canada. You know, I do think that the benchers, the governing body of the Law Society, would try not to have that influence their decision. Mm. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that in the context of this proceeding, mm. many of them will have asked themselves, would I take the same position if we were talking about a fundamentalist Islamic law school? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, your question is still a good one, because these social attitudes become deeply ingrained in us, and it's certainly possible that we may not realize that we're acting according to a bias that is kind of woven itself right into the way in which we think about the world. Mm-hmm. That's certainly possible. I think it is fair, though, that the benchers undoubtedly have tried to bracket those kinds of issues and tried to think about these issues in ways that don't fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. And conscientiously have done that, mm-hmm. Have really tried to think, is this something that could be generalized? Mm-hmm. Is this something that could apply to other religious groups? Mm-hmm. How successfully is anybody's guess, but I think that they really, they would feel, they would not want to be open to the accusation that they were engaging in some kind of religiously biased decision-making in this context.
Mm-hmm. I just worry or think that this could potentially open the door to other schools creating their own law faculties based on a code of ethics and things like that right. People have to oblige by. And given that Christianity is already in a privileged state within society, I can see how with how things are creating more programs to promote diversity and things like that, this could be a problem. Other law schools will say, well, this Christian university gets to have their own law faculty. We would like to have our own as well.
Right. That's certainly conceivable. And I have to say that my own vision of university education generally and legal education in particular is that it's good to have as many voices as possible within the lawyers or people who are engaged in the development of the law over time, people who go into government, people who serve on the court. They have to deal with the whole variety of humanity that exists in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it's really good if they encounter that diversity throughout their education. Mm-hmm. So I have to say my own feeling is the more inclusive the law school, the better, inclusive on all grounds. And the more respectful, the more you learn about other people's approaches, the better it is. There's one argument that's made in this debate is that fundamentalist Christians or even evangelical Christians don't feel terribly at home in regular law schools. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. I think we're always struggling within a law school that cares about inclusion and diversity, to try to make sure that people feel like they can speak, their mind can listen to each other, can learn from each other. And it's not always the case that we succeed. And it may well be that fundamentalist Christians don't feel that they really do feel marginalized in law schools, and that might be in part driving this. I think it's a shame. I think it's better to have a more diverse encounter in a law school, all right.
But do you think that feeling gives them the privilege to create their own law faculty because that is fundamentally based on exclusion? You know, because they feel excluded, they want to exclude themselves and isolate themselves from the rest of law learning. Should they have that privilege or that right to do that?
It's a good question. There's always a challenge. To tell you the truth, I tend to have myself an intrinsic bias towards public institutions that are broadly inclusive. Hmm. I like that at the level of the elementary and the secondary schools. I like to have institutions that have all social groups, all levels of income, so that people realize the full dimension of their society and aren't closed off. So that I confess that my tendency is the same as yours. Mm-hmm. At the same time, listen, I'm not really keen on having religious be the basis of differentiation, but I can see that there are times when minority positions aren't welcomed within general institutions, and there have to be contexts where members of, at least in some certain minorities, have a space where they can operate according to their principles. The clearest example, I think, is with minority languages. Mm-hmm. If your language is a minority language, if you, for example, are a French speaker in British Columbia, but you're always in English schools, it's your language is going to be pretty under pretty heavy pressure. Having French schools allows for a place where your children can learn their mother tongue and master their mother tongue. So there are good arguments, I think, for institutional accommodations of certain forms of diversity. Mm-hmm. The question is whether that makes sense in this kind of context, in the context of higher education, and you're right to pose the question. It's a tough question. I tend to like inclusion, but there are serious arguments mm-hmm. for there being toleration of minority-based institutions as well.
Right, but some of the arguments that I was reading was that we're comparing this to discrimination based on race and things like that. How is this different from creating schools where, you know, it's only white students or it's only black right. students? You know, with the way immigration is in Canada, white people are going to be minority. What if white people were like, well, we want to have a whites-only school? You know, yeah. would that be acceptable? Is that comparable to religious exclusivity or language exclusivity?
And in fact, in my contributions to this debate, I've used the same comparison. Mm. There have been religiously based institutions in the United States, for example, that have discriminated on the basis of race, on the basis that was a biblically mandated differentiation. And I don't think that should be acceptable. I don't think that there would be a law society in the country that would accept it. And I think it's important to ask, right, what's different in this context? Is it really that different? And I think for me, that in fact has been one of the most important questions that needs to be answered in this debate. So you're absolutely onto something. At the same time, there are instances of differentiation that do make sense. For example, Indigenous legal orders don't have much. We make a real effort and are extraordinarily proud of the attention to Indigenous legal traditions that happens within the University of Victoria Faculty of Law. Mm-hmm. But even we, as really world leaders, through the work of John Burroughs and Val Napoleon in this area, even we don't pay as much detailed, focused attention to Indigenous legal traditions as we pay to the common law. You can imagine an argument for having programs that really focus distinctively on Indigenous, on a particular Indigenous legal orders. Mm-hmm. Method of social ordering, and how that form of distinction, that form of differentiation, of institutional differentiation, would be acceptable, even meritorious. So a lot of the question is, to me, the kind of heart of the debate is to say, okay, when is it justified to have differentiation based on religious belief, or to allow for it, even if it's not your preferred option? To say, listen, it's not what I would like to see, but it should exist it should be tolerated within the spectrum of possibilities. And then when we're contemplating recognizing that for public purposes, are there any requirements that should be imposed, right? Mm-hmm. No racial discrimination, perhaps in this instance, and no discrimination in admissions on the basis of sexual orientation.
I had one comment on the fact that religious schools in the States do that. I find that really fascinating, given the fact that Jesus was Middle Eastern. I find that hilarious. But also, two questions that arise out of your Indigenous law case study for me is, would that be an exclusionary school? And I think it's different also because Indigenous law has been a minority. It has been really stamped out by the Canadian government and a history of colonialism in Canada in a way that Christianity has not, where Christianity has been privileged. And so I think that is where kind of that fine line is drawn, where one has actually been extremely oppressed for many, many years, whereas another has received quite a bit of privilege.
Well, on your first question, I think the very best would be for the mainstream law schools to pay significant attention to Indigenous legal traditions. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the way I think what we should be aspiring to do is at the University of Victoria. So absolutely, I think that would be the best. But you could understand a First Nation saying, listen, we still don't think there's enough focus on our particular tradition. We need to have ways of preserving the vigor of our traditions as living, legal traditions that can govern our societies. So I agree that the best would be to have a legal education that really works well for Indigenous students being able to find and pursue their traditions and find ways of thinking how they might relate to other, the mainstream non-Indigenous legal traditions within the country. So that I think is right. In terms of the question of, and it is true that a pattern of oppression is going to be relevant to these kinds of decisions, I guess my own feeling is that when thinking about the TWU situation, there are, of course, a whole variety of different forms of Christian belief as well. And I don't think evangelical Christians think of themselves as being a dominant majority. There's no doubt they've been socially in better position than many other religious minorities, but I think they are members of that, people who subscribe to that religious belief are in the minority, and that variant of Christianity are in the minority and do, I would say, kind of legitimately at times feel that they really that their commitments have received less respect than they would like to see. You know, I think it is true that they don't feel, they're concerned about what they see as the kind of true way, the right way to approach Christianity, and that particular way of being a Christian, I think they do see as being something that has not been, at least today, is not a majority position within Canadian society.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I have one last question because we're running out of time. I've just forgotten it, of course. Before, there was a similar decision when Trinity Western wanted to have a teacher's college,
right,
and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Do you think that this same case could go to those same levels of courts in Canada?
Yeah, it's possible. I hope that doesn't, though, stop us thinking about what is the most appropriate way to deal with this issue within the framework of the Law Society Act within BC. It is true that this may find its way before the Supreme Court of Canada, but these issues are complex. Even the Supreme Court's decision is likely to be best. The more we think through these issues, the more care we take in this debate, the more that's said in this debate, and that's what I hope happens.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.